sessions. Senate Bill 855, Senate Bill 856, Senate Bill 859, Senate Bill 5548. We will begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 855. And
due to a lack of,
we're going to have, are you going to, you're not going to introduce the, or I think we're going to have, yes.
We're going to do the, have the hearings.
We're ready for you now. 855, stability. The closest we'll get to stability for this committee is this fund. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Kate Richardson, Oregon State Treasury, and this is 855, which I'm looking for desperately. And this is the commonly called Rainy Day Fund bill, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have about that, as they pertain to the treasurer.
Co-chair Schrader.
Thank you, co-chair. What is the current liquid available amount that we're able to work with in the stability fund at this point in time, to the best of your knowledge?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Actually, I didn't realize I was the one testifying on this bill, so I don't have all the hard numbers in front of me. I think Legislative Fiscal has them. There is, to date, legislative revenue has it also. It's 200. There is, to date, about all 200 and some million in there. I can give you the hard number if you want.
Not we, Paul. But would you mind if we encourage
I would be
Ms.
helpful.
Warner to come up?
Do you want to sit down?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, let's say Revenue Office. I did prepare the summary that you have before you on the bill. And the to answer Senator Schrader's question, the estimate that we have in working with Treasury and with DAS and Legislative Fiscal Office is $112.6 million that would be available in liquid form to be transferred this biennium. Of course, that date would be something you may want to discuss. The current date of May 1st is in the Constitution for the initial 150 transfer. The components of that, that 112.6 million, is we've got 96 million currently in the account, and the account managed by Treasury. 12 million is an estimate of what the last quarterly transfer will be from DAS to the account, and that should take place around May 1st, a little before. They didn't get it before that time. And then the $4.6 million is the estimate that we have with Treasury on the liquid assets available in the currently in the Oregon Growth Account.
And, Mr. Chair, I might add, that may be 4.8, 4.9. We're getting the hard number right now.
Well,
additional question?
Will we have a hard number for this by tomorrow?
Actually, I'd hope to have it before I walked in the door, so okay. Yes.
Go ahead.
As far as date, is there a critical time period by which we need to access this fund, given our school payment situation?
Senator, we have a school payment due on May 15. That, of course, has been reduced by the special session reductions, and because all of those come out of that last payment. So it could be a part of that May 15 payment. You also keep in mind that the payment dates that you make out of the state school fund are statutory. So you can make a statutory change to create an additional payment on June 15th, for example. Now, I don't know how that would affect the schools, but you do have that within your statutory authority. But in terms of the transfer amounts, the information we have, you would be able to to transfer that before the May 15 final payment.
Okay.
Other questions? Right. Senator Dukes.
Help my memory a little bit here. Can we get on to zero in the Education Stability Fund, or do we have to keep a minimum amount in there?
Senator, I don't think that's a constitutional question. That's more in terms of kind of a working cash issue for Treasury. There isn't anything in the Constitution that says there has to be a balance in it. I just specified what the sources are.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, when the Education Endowment Fund was transformed into the Education Stability Fund, it took all the accounts that were within that fund with it. And one of those, for instance, is the Oregon Growth Account. And some of those investments and some of the cash is contractually obligated there. So it shows up as amount in the fund, but they are not available. They are legally committed.
Okay.
So, for instance, on the balance sheet, it looks like there's money in there, but there really isn't.
But we can't.
And there are some working issues in that Treasury Department of Justice costs for staffing the OGA comes out of that same fund. Those are minimal, but... So going down to an actual zero would not be, you know, frankly, doable.
Gotcha. But of the stuff that isn't tied up with that, of the other monies, we could technically go down to zero.
And that is, Senator Dukes, that is the amounts here that Paul Warner has laid out before you.
These will take us down to zero. And can you remind me of what the Oregon Growth Account is?
The Oregon Growth Account was created... several sessions ago to invest in emerging growth business, venture capital in emerging growth business in Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to check the Oregon Growth Account amount that would be left over is not liquid, but is that where the student grants would come from, or are all the student grants at this point zeroed out? And do we have any legal obligation for any existing grant applications?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, my understanding, and again, I don't have all these things here in front of me. I didn't realize I was testifying on this bill. The Student Assistant Commission comes as interest off the 90% of the Education Stability Fund that was not the 10% of the Oregon Growth Account. So, no, the Oregon Growth Account does not throw off interest for the Student Assistant Commission.
And the second part of that, Mr. Chair, was then do we have any legal obligations outstanding for the student grant for the student commission at this particular point out of any remaining balance at this point?
Representative Butler, my understanding is that the legal obligation is on interest earnings. So obviously, if there's nothing in the account, there won't be interest earnings. So, and that of course feeds into the 0305 biennium. So that. The legal obligation is to commit the interest earnings. If there's not interest earnings, then there's not a legal obligation.
And final question, then. We're withdrawing the money before there is any interest earnings on this, so there are, or the interest earnings have been segregated so that we're not even considering them at this point.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two quick questions. Obviously, the source here is lottery funds. How often are monies credited to the accounts, and how much do we anticipate to be credited to the account in the 0305 biennium phase?
Senator Devlin, the lottery transfer to the account is on a quarterly basis. It goes through DAS. I don't have the estimate with me, but it's 18%. Of net lottery proceeds for 0305. So it goes from 15%, which it is now, to 18%. The estimate is right around $50 million per year.
Other questions? Thank you.
Good question for Paul,
if I may.
Sure. Why don't you just run this? There's not much to this bill, but I'd like to get on record the fact that we met the constitutional triggers, that sort of thing, sir.
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chair, the bill, the first thing that the bill does is states that there is a finding. The legislature makes a finding. And if you remember Measure 19, there were three conditions, and they were or conditions, not and conditions. And one of them had to do with employment, declining employment over a two quarters over a 12-month period. It's marginal whether we meet that or not now. Those numbers are revised, but at the moment, we have had employment growth over the last 12 months. The employment losses we had were really in 01. But the second trigger is the current revenue forecast. And you'll notice in the bill it refers to the December forecast. Well, you will have, of course, a March update on Friday to refer to. But that states that the current forecast is 2% or more below the close of session. Well, that's the trigger. That's the finding here. We're now running about 18% below the close of session. So that trigger clearly is going to be in effect. And that's the finding here that triggers MAT. Now, then that allows you to direct the treasurer to commit additional funds out of the stability fund, and the Constitution does not direct you to put these funds in the state school fund. It directs you to use them for public education. So you do have more latitude than that, even though the specific bill commits it to the state school fund and the initial transfers to the state school fund. It has to be general education. So you have more flexibility there. Okay, the same language actually was in the original education endowment fund. But and even though you do have a finding that one of the triggers is met, the Constitution still requires you to take a three-fifths vote in each chamber in order to withdraw anything from the fund.
Another questions? Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If there's an answer to this question from someone, what are the consequences to the Oregon growth account?
Go ahead and repeat your question, if you would, Senator Gordley. Would you please repeat your question for me?
I'm wondering, what are the consequences to the Oregon growth account by removing the $4.6 million?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, the Oregon growth account would not be able to invest those monies in any particular ventures that came before it.
Are there any ventures waiting in line, Mr. Chair, that would be immediately hampered?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, there was an Oregon Growth Account meeting yesterday. I was not able to attend. My understanding is that a certain number of proposals came before them, but I do not believe any decisions were made about them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? All right. Is there anyone else who's going to testify on Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Jim Craven from the American Electronics Association. It's actually our group working with this body in 1995 that created the Oregon Growth Account concept. So I guess I'm here appearing as a Oregon Growth Account lobbyist. We've been working last several days with the state treasurer and LFO. I just wanted to commend both those institutions for sorting this out, because there was a question about current balances versus committed funds, and I think as far as I can tell now, we're down to the uncommitted corpus of that part, and that was very critical that we there are some funds being held by the Treasury but have been committed to some of the venture fund managers. We wanted to make absolutely sure that didn't get undone, and the treasurer's commitments to those funds didn't get undone, and I don't think that's the intention here. And I just you know, want to urge you to, you know, over the next 24 hours to work with LFO and the treasurer to, if there is that residual that needs to be maintained so it doesn't bleed down to zero, so there's no staffing for the next several months to support the OGA, if we can find a way to do that, that would be very much appreciated. I've talked to a couple of the OGA board members this morning, and I mean, they understand the situation you're in this week, and they do appreciate making sure that the commitments we have are honored, and that if there is some set of funds that are needed just to bridge in, the OGA will begin to be replenished in 03-05, just as the Stability Fund will begin to be replenished, and they can move forward with their fine work. So thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you for that testimony. I think we understand the difference between the committed and uncommitted, and we are confident that that which is now uncommitted will remain so.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 855? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 855. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 856.
Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Schrader.
I guess I'd like to have, if it's possible, have Paul Warner and the Treasury Department come up together on this.
That'd be fabulous.
Fabulous? Fabulous. Oh, Mr. Dick Yates will be.
Mr. Yates will be coming.
Much more succinct, like usual, on this.
We're not seeing a rating sweep, so we're bringing in the big ones. Welcome, gentlemen. Kate, back. Please proceed.
May I?
Yes.
May I help them proceed, sir?
Yes, sure can.
I guess the first point I'd like to get clear is that I'm getting the distinct feeling from conversations this morning that our impending forecast to be officially released on February 28th for March is beyond disaster, and very, very serious issues that try the not even the worst of the worst case scenarios that we've been thinking about. And as a result of that, I guess I want to make it clear to the committee that we're going to have to take some extraordinary action here to balance our budget for 0103 and keep an open mind as to the dollar amount we may have to plug in tomorrow. And Dick, to the extent you're capable or feel comfortable just talking about some of the downside factors that have not gotten better since our talks of 2 weeks ago, I'd appreciate you comment a little bit. Or is that a Paul conversation?
That probably is a better a Paul conversation.
I'd like to say,
or somebody else.
Anybody else. I think it's important for this panel and the public to understand in a thoughtful manner, so things just don't happen and they wonder why. We have to get a little.
Are you suggesting the Senate President's media availability was not thoughtful?
Well, I think we need to make sure it's in a proper form.
Glad to have you, Mr. Warner. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, I just needed to know exactly which are the overflow rooms so that the 400 people who were here last night could hear this.
That'd be nice.
That's a good point. Please proceed.
Senator Schrader, the question really is kind of what the risk potential is there. Is that?
Yeah, how has that changed from our December forecast so that we might prepare ourselves for the horrible stuff that the pro tem were talking about earlier today?
Okay. As you recall, we've discussed the payment stream coming in almost daily and watching that, as is the state economist as he prepares the forecast to be ready for you on Friday. But I think the thing that we've noticed that is most concerning is the estimated payments that were due January 15th were about 20% below the prior year. The estimated payments are particularly critical. They're the people that are not making withholding payments. It's usually business income, investment income, real estate income, and so forth, rental income. there's two of those payments due throughout the rest of the biennium, April 15 and June 15. the last 3 months of the fiscal year in an income tax system, you get a disproportionately large amount of your net collections. You obviously have April 15th within those last 3 months, in which even on May 15th, we won't know fully what those returns have shown. And you also have the two quarterly payments coming in. You have two corporate quarterly payments. So the risk here is that you've got about over $1.5 billion in revenue in the last 3 months. So you can think in terms of potential error on that. Given even what we see on Friday, you could easily be looking at another $100 to $200 million as a possible risk. And given the pattern that we've seen, those payments that have come in, those payments are really tied back to 2002. The tax year that we know is very much a recession year. The quarterly payments, most people are making a safe harbor. They're paying based on what they had to pay last year. So even if the economy starts to pick up in the next few months, we're probably not going to really see that until next fiscal year. So my expectation is that we're certainly not out of the woods for this biennium, and we still have considerable risk over the last 5 months of this biennium.
So if I may...
4 months.
Excuse me, Senator Devine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may have actually just basically going to be asking the same question that you're asking and the same clarification. Is when you say $100 to $200 million, you're talking beyond what we already know the forecast may show this Friday.
That's correct, Senator. I'm really referring to that last 3 months of the biennium, which is that April, May, June period, and which remember your risk even goes beyond May 15th, because June is typically a relatively high collection month. So there you have to think in terms of not just the forecast, but that revenue stream going all the way out through June 30th.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Morris. Representative Butler and Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Paul, could you back up the December reduction of was it $112 million?
That's correct, Senator.
And develop this chronology and the dollars so that where this total risk may fall out as you see it. What's the worst case if you just total these reductions starting with a December reduction?
Okay. Actually, Senator, I think the December forecast was down 127, left us $112 million deficit. in terms of the risk, as you look out over that period, I think that you've heard the state economists talk about the risk over this remainder of the biennium and assigned a risk of $300 million for the potential for the rest of the biennium. I think, given the patterns that we are in now, I would add at least 100 to that. So that would be off the December forecast. You'd be looking at a risk of at least 400. And that's again keeping in mind that the risk is not linear with the calendar year. It's when you get those April 15 payments coming in, it's going to swing you one way or another. If you've underestimated or overestimated what tax liability was in 2002, you're going to end up with bigger refunds and smaller final payments. And what it does is it just exaggerated things. And, I can speak from personal experience in the 90s that happened the other way. It would just blow up on me in April and May, because those refunds turned out to be smaller and we got a lot of final payments coming off the exact opposite of what we're seeing now, with strong investment income, strong capital gains, flowing in strong estimated payments as people realize they were underpaid. So we're seeing the exact opposite of that occur now.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to get much further into the potential forecast that we'll receive on Friday from Mr. Katowski, but I would like to just address two issues, Paul. One, my understanding is that the treasurer holds the books of the state open for collections received shortly beyond June 30th. What day do we hold our books open to receive the final June 30 payments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, the general fund revenue is on a cash basis, with one exception. That is withholding receipts. In fact, we go over a little bit of history of this. In 1982, in a similar situation you're in now, there was an extension of 10 days of withholding receipts, up 10 working days, that would be counted in the prior biennium. With accounting systems more sophisticated, what's done now is the Department of Revenue can flag withholding receipts that come in, primarily from smaller employers, because they have a longer lag as to when they mm-hmm. send those in. They'll count 30 days, the entire month of July, any withholding receipts that they can flag as a liability back to June, and they will count that in the prior biennium. So those numbers we don't know for sure until end of August.
And then a follow-up, Mr. Chair. So in addition to those receipts, which are up to 30 days and then retroactively added back to the general fund balance, we have just, and I'm trying to remember if there's more than just the new tobacco which flows into another account, not a general fund account, not a lottery fund account. Is there more than just the tobacco money, the new tobacco money that's flowing into a dedicated account of a new resource that would have been, but for other legislative action, considered to be general fund?
You're thinking in terms of kind of the discretionary
exactly.
Budget that the legislative fiscal office has developed. Well, the MUPL money is a big component of that. Cigarette tax revenue and the tobacco settlement revenue, or all three, have been treated that way. Now, also keep in mind that you did use $99 million of tobacco settlement money in the regular session and deposited that in the general fund. So that became general fund. That was what you used as an ending balance when you closed the 01 session. You'll also have an issue with Senate Bill 856 on how to treat revenue bond revenues, whether to treat those as general fund or as other fund.
They did. But just one follow-up, Mr. Chair, in that regard. I just want to make certain that truly new money, really the new cigarette money that comes in under Measure 20, is in a discretionary dedicated fund.
That's correct, Representative Butler. The new money that's coming in Measure 20 goes directly to Oregon Health Plan. It's dedicated, that is other fund revenue.
All right, thank you. So it generates a new other fund, not general fund or lottery.
Yes, it actually adds to the existing other fund that was created with Measure 44.
Good, thank you.
Additional questions? Co-Chair Schrader.
Just a comment. Well, I'm just trying to frame the discussion. Maybe it's a little premature, but there's a hope that we have the opportunity to move forward and closure on 0103 now that we have some preliminary numbers on the forecast here for March. And it's correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that in the fifth special session, we gave the go-ahead to securitize $150 million in future tobacco receipts, tobacco summit receipts. That has not actually been done yet. The bond has not gone to market, so to speak, at this point in time.
That's correct.
The original, December forecast gave us great pause, and so leadership and the whole Legislative Assembly Ways and Means got very concerned. We talked about a different growth rate than the governor's budget and trying to make ends meet with our fancy sheets that we were getting. We were looking at possibly securitizing and or doing an appropriation credit deal for another $150 million, as I recollect, $120 to $150 million. Does that sound vaguely familiar to anybody here? Okay. I guess what I'm getting at is, based on this new forecast, so that no one's surprised, we're probably looking at doing another $150 million on top of that to actually make ends meet. And the goal would be, ladies and gentlemen, the problem, we're in a bind here. The question immediately comes up is, do we really need that? Do we really need that right now? And right away, the second question comes up, or second response comes up, well, the treasurer needs to know right now to get to an April 7th bond sale what number are we going to fill in on this bill before us. So the next thing, pretty good monologue, huh? It not like Seinfeld bill or anything. But the next question that obviously comes up is, okay,
frame this thing.
Right. If Senator Schrader, we have to go for this enchilada type of approach, we're talking maybe $450 million in appropriation credit. What sidebars can we put on that so that if by some miracle the forecast gets better, or May just looks like, you know, the economy turns around and Intel builds 20 new plants in Oregon, even in Klamath Falls, that there's an opportunity to restore our vision of Oregon. How can we put some fences around this money so that it doesn't just go out for Kurt Schrader's favorite little pork project? So I'm directing that to the Treasury.
Go ahead, Kate.
For the record, Kate Richardson, Oregon State Treasury, wishing she wasn't at the moment. When Mr. Chair, if I may ask you, when you're talking about sidebars, are you talking about putting them into the appropriation credit itself or putting some restrictions on the money once it's received?
Probably more the latter, and wondered what your recommendations would be, or is there something we need to put in the appropriation credit bill?
That's yours.
Okay. For the record, I'm Chuck Smith with the Oregon State Treasury. I wouldn't recommend, Mr. Chair, that you put a lot of additional sort of internal workings into this particular bill, but do it the way you initially suggested, controlling the proceeds and managing it that way. The reason you want to do this, you want to introduce yourself and introduce a new bonding program to the market with a clean, straight-ahead kind of bond program that's readily understood by a new set of investors out there that will see this bond for the first time. So the details of controlling the proceeds should, I would recommend, be somewhere else. We had spoken a little bit earlier today about two bond sales, and at that moment, all of maybe an hour or two ago, it seemed to be $300 million for one and $50 million for another. Now we're talking about some substantially different numbers here. I suppose that would be one concept. Another concept was to something I think that was addressed a little bit in that previous meeting, was the endowment fund perhaps being used as a balancer, mixed with bond appropriations to come up with what now looks like it's $450 million. We could do two sales if need be. That's expensive to do it that way. One right after the other is not the most attractive way to get a new bond program going in the marketplace. But there, perhaps that or other mechanisms could be devised to give you the kind of flexibility you're looking for.
Paul? You bring up the point, can't we just do several transactions? I think we run up, as many members know, there's this big bond sale that New York and California are going to go to the market on that would affect us severely that way.
Yeah, we have to. Yeah.
What about just different call dates? Can't we just do different call dates to pull it back? Say we overbond, and can't we just pull it back earlier? Can't we do that? What's the downside of that?
Mr. Chair, to pull it back...
In a month or two or three.
That's... not a bond market practice. I'm not sure that you could sell those. What you're saying to somebody is, would you want to buy these bonds? And you can own these bonds for 2 months or 9 years. And I can't tell you that right now.
Okay.
So.
Oh, that's good. That's good. What, Matt, follow up again?
Well,
someone
of course.
Else? So, well, Jesus, bonding thing, you know, we hate bonding. We were never going to do this in the first special session. This is like against our religion. It just wasn't something we were going to do. But, you know, unfortunately, we don't have any money anymore, at least any ongoing revenues. We're in a world of hurt. What about some other issues? We talked about maybe doing a line of credit. We talked about doing some borrowing from our other internal reserves. Do we get a better interest rate on that? Are there any legal problems we run into by trying to do that? Why isn't that better than this appropriation credit?
Mr. Chair, borrowing, can whether it's a bond, a note, or a line of credit, is just that. It's borrowing. A line of credit, because banks cannot take full advantage of tax-exempt interest, banks on a line of credit would need to charge you a taxable rate. we can access the capital markets at a tax exempt rate where they will pay the full value for the tax exemption and lower our interest cost and therefore the overall cost of this borrowing very substantially by doing it into the capital markets rather than through a line of credit at a bank.
Mr. Chair, if I might add too, and just depending on the different types of borrowing too, you may be running into the constitutional debt limitation and you would need to get advice from counsel dependent on the borrowing. This particular structure has already passed that test.
Could you elaborate on the constitutional limitation for borrowing?
Well, I'm not legislative counsel, but there is a constitutional debt limitation of $50,000, and there are different vehicles that don't fall under that limitation and aren't recognized as borrowing in the same way, or as a debt of the state in the same way. This is COPs is one. This is another that is not, because this credit is an appropriation subject to appropriation. It is not considered a debt of the state subject to the debt limitation.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If on the unneeded proceeds from this sale, could those be set aside into a reserve fund that would be used to do debt service and like make the final payment or ending payments? Just, I've got some familiarity with some unexpended general revenue bonds that local government would issue, and the money would just go back into the eventual repayment of the bonds. But
we can put it back into debt service.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that may be possible. I'm not sure what the tax implications of that is or not, but because this is a general fund appropriation credit that is earmarking the MSA revenues, you can choose which revenues you want to pay debt service. It might be, you know, moving one into another, and there may be tax implications. I wouldn't be the person to answer that. At this point, I would say it may be possible.
Was a response to Senator Schrader's pork enchilada problem.
Mm-hmm.
But you could to clarify that this money isn't flipped through the cracks, that it'd be earmarked for repayment. Any unexpenditure, just earmark them for eventual debt service.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, you could use unexpended proceeds to pay debt service. There would be certain costs involved in that, but, for instance, as they sat around, they would be invested at a rate that's less than the rate that it costs on the bond, so you'd have some negative arbitrage involved. But if that was determined in a fairly short period of time, you could use them to pay debt service. But we have to remember, some of the debt service, I mean, this debt service would be spread out over a number of years. So it isn't like there's $300 million worth of debt service due the first year, and you could say, well, I'll just take, you know, everything left over and put it the first year. So, but there are certain constraints involved, but you raise a good question, Representative Hansen, and that is some of it, to some extent, could be used to pay and set aside and pay the debt service on these, and therefore free up the tobacco monies to be used for other purposes.
Mr. Chair, if I could add something on, you know, I think you can think about, let's say that these are not dollars that you need to balance 0103, that you end up with selling more in bonds than you need to actually technically balance. Well, of course, the amount that you have above what you need to balance becomes your beginning balance for 0305. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you have balances to work with at Treasury, you're going to boost general fund interest earnings, and you're going to have resources in 0305 that would be available. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's if you took no other steps.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I worked through a step transaction previously with legislative counsel. It was my understanding from counsel, but I did not go so far as to seek an actual legal opinion, but it's my understanding that we could borrow within this current legislative assembly and encumber ourselves for the old 305 to the repayment thereof too. And the question I specifically asked at that time was whether any portion of the industrial accident fund, which is invested and happens to be losing money on a regular basis, could be invested or could be borrowed to meet some of the general obligations, and with a repayment clause that we would pay the greater of either the earnings on the account as it was being borrowed, that is, if the investments in the marketplace continued to yield losses, that you would still pay back, then the greater of, which would be the second interest rate, and that would be the interest that we would have had to go to market for, thus relieving us of the concern that we've got of the states of New York and California going to the market at the same time that the state of Oregon was. That is, we're borrowing from an internal fund without the bonding costs, but only the borrowing costs, and paying, number one, an interest rate which would be equal to whatever our market rate interest was, or the greater of, and if the industrial accident account struck gold and the whole market started to go haywire and earned 15% interest, then at that point the state would repay to the industrial accident account up to 15%. Could that save us the bonding costs and provide us another avenue of going of seeking these funds internally without competing with other major municipal bond issuers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it's actually my understanding in the very, very brief conversation I had with counsel, Department of Justice, our counsel for this matter, is that there are various legal problems that could be presented there, and we don't have the benefit of the full analysis at the moment. But the fund would need to be made whole, so you would be paying whatever it would be to keep it whole. There may be call issues implicated there, so if the fund, if needed that money, it could be called immediately. And there are other, because it's someone else's money, I mean, we're fiduciaries, so there may be other implications there. I can't answer that fully here.
Mr. Chair, the precept was, number one, you would be paying the greater of the interest rate at the market rate, or whatever they earn. So if they earn nothing, you would still pay the current interest rate, and we can obligate ourselves within the current legislature to we could use it for the 0103 balance and then repay it within the 0305 our current fiscal period that we're balancing for, and do that by a combination of any number of schemes to borrow that from. And number two issue was that Kate brought up, and justifiably so, is, wait a minute, would you have some call obligation on these particular funds? It's my understanding that some of these funds are set aside to pay off obligations 60 years from now. And so I doubt that there would be a current obligation to pay some of those back immediately, but as long as we're paying at least the interest rate, which would be considered the interest rate that we would pay to anyone else, without the bonding costs and without the competition of other municipalities going to Wall Street at the same time as the state of Oregon, and if the higher interest rate is what they earned, and may God bless them if they could earn 15%, because then everybody earns 15% because of the commonality of the trust funds. So there wouldn't be an immediate demand for it. It's deemed, or it would be, we considered that there wouldn't be an immediate demand for it. But those are items of discussion. We could borrow from within our own funds and pay a better-than-market interest rate and still meet our interest rate without the competition and without the additional bond costs right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, all I can say to that point at this moment is that Department of Justice, in looking at that race and when that question was raised earlier today, raised some concerns and said that they would really have to look that one over before that seemed a possibility to them. And I don't want to venture on where their analysis would lead.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. hardly seems possible that we're only just a little bit past the sixth week of this session. Mm-hmm. Seems like we've been here a lot longer.
Yeah.
Well, we have in another way. But going back to our discussions probably only about a week or 10 days ago, when we were talking about $150 million and we were talking about that we would no longer have to do securitization, that we would use this other vehicle, the general discussion was that the cost of borrowing would be significantly less, in addition to the money that would go to pay back these bonds, or however you can consider them, an OHSU, that there would be some liquid funds still available for the state as part of the settlement, and it would take 7 to 8 years to pay back the obligation. Obviously, our cost of borrowing is going to go up to be more, but is the actual discount or interest rate going to be more when we try to go out for this larger amount, which is going to be over a prolonged, much more prolonged period of time? And what sort of time frame are we talking about? Are we talking about not, well, obviously we will not be talking about 7 to 8 years. Are we talking 12 to 14 years, 14 to 16 years? What kind of interest, what kind of discount rate are we going to pay on the money to get us to July 1st of this year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, if we're talking about borrowing, say, approximately $400 million, or $450 million, I think we're looking, if we go to $450, we're looking at probably a 10-year type of borrowing. And once again, this is sort of the driver is the underlying revenue stream, which is the tobacco, estimated tobacco MSA payments in the future, less certain money set aside to pay other kind of state obligations. Everything left over goes to pay these bonds. The more you borrow, the further you obviously have to stretch out the maturity. So we would be looking at 10-year bonds and would be looking at interest costs that would be, 3.5% to 3.75%. This would have the capacity to repay $450 million worth of borrowing in a 10-year period.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask for a clarification just so I understand?
Please do.
Actually from the chair or one of the co-chairs. When he's saying 400 to 450 million, I mean, that would be a scenario under which we were going to take 400 to 450, still take the money from the stability fund. So we would be asking to, rather than taking 300 and taking 100 plus from the stability fund, we could be potentially asking for 450 plus 100 from the stability fund.
Clarification would be that 150 of that 450 is to balance this last special session prior to this special
session. Oh, that's
session
right. Okay, five. I'm getting that. Okay.
And that's a very clear point, important point. The bond sale may be 400, 450. The amount we're worried about for this session that we've
thank you for that clarification. So before we were talking about the 150 plus 150. Now we're talking about the 150 plus 300.
That is correct.
Okay.
Senator Dukes, I think had a
thank you. Actually, Representative Senator Devlin asked most of my questions, but now what would that, if we securitized that 450 million using master settlement agreement monies, what would it cost us? I mean, compare the 3.5 to 3/4, 3.75 when we're borrowed.
Then you can answer your question.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, there's been some adverse trends in the interest rates of tobacco bonds lately, and that is they've been going up sharply because a number of states have entered the market here and will be entering the market over the next month or two to bring billions and billions of tobacco bonds to market. They've gotten high interest rates. So if you're looking to compare what an appropriation state credit would be to the tobacco bonds, a securitization, you're looking at interest rates on tobacco bonds that could be at least 2% higher, depends on the maturity and so forth. And that translates into obviously millions of dollars of additional interest costs.
Okay. Does the Treasury have an opinion if we securitize basically the money, the obligation, the whole thing is gone, we're done, it does what it, as long as everything comes in like it's supposed to, and actually that's part of the risk they take.
Well, Senator, actually under the securitization, the idea would, it started out as a four-year securitization. And all tobacco monies that were after setting aside monies for OHSU and so forth, all the tobacco monies would be used and it would be a four-year transaction. The appropriate, but yet at the end of 4 years or 8 or 9 years, if you wanted to borrow more, 10 years, whatever it is, at the end of that period of time, the all the MSA tobacco payments would be available for state purposes. The same would hold true for this appropriation credit, and that is, once again, the tobacco revenue comes in, and the concept would be to take a slice, say $30 million, set it aside for other state purposes, including the OHSU general obligation bonds, and then take all of the remaining MSA payments and use it to make debt service on these bonds to retire them as fast as possible. When you get when you move from $150 million to $300 to $450 million, you obviously have to utilize those tobacco payments over much longer periods of time. So now when we're talking about, say, $450, just for an example of proceeds, or $400 to $450, we're talking about using all the tobacco proceeds for about a 10-year period of time. After 10 years, all the tobacco proceeds would be available to be used for any other state purpose.
What I was asking was, do you have an opinion upon the one which says pretty much it's done, it's locked into the agreement, this is what happens, and the other which says the legislature agrees to commit these funds, agrees to itself to commit these funds for the next 10 years? I guess I'm fiscally conservative, but I have just watched the legislature change the rules and move stuff around for too many years, and it makes me very nervous to tie up this, to agree. I mean,
sealed.
Every parachute we've got has failed upon opening in the last year, and now we're saying we're going to trust ourselves enough to put $450 million on the line for a stream of money that we believe we will continue to spend that way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't seen us default on anything since I've been here. I've seen us get really creative. So I'm just asking if you have any official position financially. And then I would also ask where this puts us on borrowing. There must be a ceiling up there someplace. How close are we getting to it?
Well, Senator, there's several questions there. Certainly, the state of Oregon has always paid its obligation in a timely fashion, and investors would be looking to these bonds, even though they are an appropriation credit, which requires the legislature to act every 2 years to pay the debt service. Investors are going to be looking to the state as standing up paying these bonds at the proper moment, and certainly we've done that in the past. We've used an appropriation-style financing for the last 12 or 13 years. That's the Certificates of Participation, or COPs. That's an appropriation credit. Every 2 years, the legislature has appropriated sufficient funds to pay the more than $800 million that we've borrowed through COPs to build prisons and so forth. This credit offers, an appropriation credit offers an opportunity, especially compared to the conditions in the tobacco bond market, offers an opportunity to very substantially cut the state's payments, cuts the state's interest rate, and cut the state's total payments back on the bonds to millions and millions of dollars. We're looking at over just the life of this deal, you could be talking about saving $20 or $30 million in total cost. So if the state is willing to say, yes, we will appropriate that, even in tough times and good times, we have the full intention today to appropriate this in the future, the state can save $20 or $30 million.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I'd add that's $20 or $30 million on a $300 million deal. That it would be. It would be even more, of course, should the amount be increased.
Mr. Chair?
Well, probably not, but go ahead.
Just in time. I was going to. I guess I'd like to make a couple points, and correct me if I'm wrong, but following up on what Senator Dukes is saying, the advantage of this appropriation state credit issuance, the reason, one of the reasons our interest rates are so much less is we're obligating full faith of the state of Oregon. And as a result, it's a little different than the Tobacco Settlement Corporation, where we shielded ourselves a little bit from some of the risk, and therefore it's more attractive to investors. They know they're going to get their money. We are, relatively speaking, a very low indebted state. That wasn't true in the 80s, but we've cleaned things up a bit, and so we're a very low indebted state, so we actually have room. Not that I'm suggesting we should try and fill that up, but these are tough times. I would like to get to Representative Butler's point on the Industrial Accident Fund. The reason I mentioned at the beginning the idea of doing some inter-agency borrowing, that would seem logical. Geez, you know, it's our own people. We could have lower interest rates. We could charge ourselves 1% or 2% and not have to worry about that. But as I recollect in the conversation with the Common School Fund, when we were going to do that, the legal eagles came back saying, no, boys and girls, you have to repay them with a market rate interest or above. Therefore, my understanding is if we did the inter-department or inter-reserve type of loan, not only does it raise legal questions, but we have a no repayment stream necessarily like we do with the tobacco settlement. We actually have a way to repay the bonds or whatever. At this point, if we try and do an inter-department or inter-reserve, we have no way to pay it back. If we had a way to pay it back, we wouldn't be borrowing in the first place.
Yeah.
And last but not least, the interest rate is going to be substantially lower with this appropriation credit at 3.5% versus a market rate, which is what, 7% something like that. So it just, I guess that's where I'm going. Otherwise, that would be with Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, and if I, as I sat there thinking about it, I think there's one other issue that I believe does run afoul of the debt limitation, too, because you're obligating the credit of the state. Here, where this is an appropriation credit, so subject to appropriation, but this would be actually, there's no revenue stream, this would be actually obligating the state's credit. So it, I think it carries that problem as well.
Okay. We're done framing now?
Yes, sir.
So, all right. I'm gonna proceed with your testimony on 856.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, you have before you just a summary sheet about what an appropriation credit is and what this bill would do. We do have a couple of little amendments out there. I don't believe they're out of council, but that would just be not changing anything substantively. However, the summary before you is contemplating a $300 million borrowing, so the rates you see, the final maturity there would be on $300 million about 7 to 8 years, and it outlines the interest costs for you. Again, this would be an appropriation credit, but the bill earmarks, doesn't pledge, but earmarks the tobacco MSA payments for the debt service. No, it's okay. Mr. Chair, do you have any questions about this, or do you want to walk through the bill, or
yeah, why don't
we serve you?
Go ahead.
Why don't you go ahead now?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, with respect to the written testimony here entitled Oregon Appropriation Bonds, I think actually the questions have taken care of a significant portion of these. One of the other features of the bonds we talk about is we could get these bonds insured and rated AAA and therefore lower our total costs. You can't insure a tobacco bond, and no insurance company has been willing to do that so far. So that would be another aspect to take into account when you're talking about an appropriation credit. You can get them insured. I've listed just a few items down here. The fourth bullet is sort of important, and co-chair addressed that just a moment ago. Appropriation bonds have an implicit moral obligation of the state. And that is that even though the legislature will be requested to appropriate every 2 years the debt service on these bonds, investors fully expect to be paid principal and interest in a timely fashion by the state. And up to now, certainly the state has paid all its bonds in complete and in timely fashion. Once again, the numbers that appear here were the $300 million example. That's obviously got to be scaled up now. Yep. And plus, all the numbers we're running with the master settlement payments less $30 million that I've referred to a number of times. And the $30 million would cover Oregon Health Science University, general obligation bonds, and as well as an additional $10 to $12 million over and above those. So there would be those monies that would be available to the legislature to appropriate if the master settlement agreement monies flow as forecasted.
Mr. Co-Chair, that buffer, that 10 to 12, allows for some fluctuation in the MSA payments to the state. It also would provide or potentially provides for enforcement of the master settlement agreement as well, some funds to provide enforcement, because obviously the state would have a strong interest in enforcing the agreement. And we were trying to allow for the debt service and enough wiggle room there that we wouldn't be caught short.
Are there questions?
Mr. Co-Chair,
Representative Bates.
I've been pulled in and out all afternoon. I apologize for that. Can these bonds be paid back before the maturity without penalty?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, the bonds could have a call feature, for instance, a five-year call feature would be an example. The state would pay somewhat more interest rate in order to retain that option, which is valuable. So interest rates could be, for instance, 0.25% higher on those callable bonds in 5 years. But the state would have an option to exercise that. Another thing we have to remember about the bonds is that they're not a single maturity, a single bullet, or a single term bond. Every year, bonds will be retired. And in fact, if we take a look at this, by the fifth year, we see that in a 7 or 8 year kind of transaction, more than $200 million out of this $300 million example, more than $200 million in bonds would have already been retired. So it's not a bullet. We pay every year a certain portion of the principal back, and so that helps lower the outstanding balance very substantially and very quickly, given the fact that our example here is a 7 year bond for the $300 million example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify?
Yeah.
On Senate Bill 856. If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 856. And I don't see that. Oh, here we go.
Thank you.
We've got two more. Well, I think we've got. We have the bill.
Yeah, I know.
No, we don't have that.
Yeah, we do. It's in your bill file.
Public hearing.
We introduced this, right?
Yeah, we did. We introduced this.
We have a public hearing. We don't have anything in it.
We just introduced it. We haven't had a public hearing yet.
I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 859. Is there anyone wishing to testify on Senate Bill 859 at this time? If not, I think we'll see this again maybe tomorrow. If not, then we'll close the public hearing and thank the witnesses on Senate Bill 859. And we have also one other bill we could
5548.
Could deal with, yes. 5548, is that not until tomorrow? Okay. Is there any other business to come before the committee? We are scheduled for tomorrow at 3 o'clock, at which time we may have some decisions affecting the closing of the 0103 biennium.
Gary, you're
so, please
you're
be present if the schedule permits. Thank you for your attendance. 3 o'clock tomorrow. With that, we are adjourned.